attaboy. Yeah, that's right. We're going to ride farther and faster than the normal ride. Oh, yeah, boy. You're ready. Saddle's on and cinched up tight. Stick that head over here and let me get that bit in your mouth. Now the bridle's on. We have a special ride today, Lightning. It's a super studcast day. Time to give our fans the very best. And we're going to climb a couple of wrestling mountains and ride into history.
Yeehaw!
Welcome to our patrons for part two of Super Studcast number 26. We hope you enjoyed part one. The Stud has a very special part two in store for you. This one is something very different than what you will find in other Super Studcasts. This one is some of Ron's favorite stories, 30 in all, about not only the sport of his family, but stories that paint a picture of what wrestling was all about in its heyday. Almost all of these stories have never been told on Studcast or Super Studcast. Ron thought you might enjoy looking at things from a jovial point of view. It is, as all things with Ron, a unique look at a unique sport and those odd and strange people that gave us all so much enjoyment. So, rear back in that saddle, pull your cowboy hat down tight, and enjoy this special time with the Tennessee Stud.
Welcome, everybody, to Super Studcast number 26, part two. Ron, as I mentioned to you before we start recording, John Lennon once wrote, "Life is what happens while you're busy making other plans." Ron, why don't you talk about Sid Vicious?
Well, you know, wrestling's a little bit different nowadays than it used to be, and I've had great results here on Super Studcast, dealing with people that have worked for me, basically, that I have a relationship, and they know kind of what my parameters are and what I like, and I know the same about them. And in Sid's case, Sid was supposed to be on with us for part two here, and Sid had other things to do, and you know, he didn't really notify anybody in advance, and so. It's just part of doing what we do. And, you know, I feel bad about that. I want to apologize to fans here that I really thought I would be able to get Sid on for part two of this. And I may still have him on someday because he was a big star. But today he's not on here. And I feel like what we're going to do today might be even better to our patrons out there. And I really... that's who I'm interested in here, obviously, today is our patrons. And today I have something totally different I have not done before. I'm going to basically tell about 30 stories that I don't think hardly any of them have ever been told on a studcast or a super studcast before. And I feel like I'm going to take folks on a ride today that is going to be, hopefully it's going to be funny. I hope they're going to have a really good time. Sid won't be with us today, and he may not be with us anymore, but I don't think you're going to miss him today, folks. And I'm really looking forward to this. And if you don't mind, Jeff, I'm going to jump right into it. I want to start out with a guy, and when I tell these stories today, because this is old school, folks, this is not, these aren't the young boys you're going to see on A&E, A&W, or M&M, or whatever the damn names are of today's shows. This is going to be a lot of old timers, and I think some of them will ring a lot of people's bells, and some of them, they'll probably be scratching their head, but I think the story's what's important. And I'm going to start off with a guy named Tex Riley. Tex Riley wrestled back in my grandfather's day in the 40s, 50s, 60s, came from Texas. He had these big old ears on him, man, looked like doorknobs hanging off the side of his head. He both of them cauliflowered like my grandfather's ears. I mean, it was customary back in those days that you had not one, but two cauliflower ears. So, Tex Riley happened to be working in a town that my dad's running. My dad's just getting started. My grandfather owns the wrestling territory in Tennessee, which is most of the South. And he let my dad run a couple of towns over in Arkansas and Missouri across the Mississippi River on the west side of the river. And one of them was Caruthersville, Missouri. And in Caruthersville, Missouri, Tex Riley's wrestling this particular night, and it's a fairly small crowd, and Riley's in the ring, and there's a guy sitting on the first row of ringside, and he's heckling Riley. And Riley is a babyface. I think that's why Tex gets mad here, is because he's not used to it. So Tex is wrestling in his match, and this guy keeps screaming at him, "Riley, you got buggy whip arms, and Riley, you're ugly, Riley." And then he got on his cauliflower ears. He says, "God, look at those cauliflower ears." He says, "You look like a taxi cab going down the street with both back doors open." And Riley had heard enough, so he hit the floor, and he goes over to the guy, and he grabs him by the shoulders. And the guy's not a big guy, you know, and Riley doesn't really look around to see what the guy has with him or whatever. He just grabs him by the shoulders, and he snatches him straight up in the air. And when he does, this poor guy's legs just start swinging underneath his body. And Riley looks down, and there's crutches underneath the guy's chair. So Riley, he can't do anything to the guy at this point. You know, my goodness, he's a cripple. So Riley, you know, he says, you know, he's holding him up face to face with him. And he says, "You better shut your mouth," you know, and he sets him back down. And so Riley goes ahead and wrestles the rest of the match. And my dad's a young promoter, you know, and he watches the deal, and he sees the crutches under the chair, and he realizes the same thing Riley realized. So Riley comes back in after the match is over, or it's a 2 out of 3 fall, and after the fall is over, whatever. And he sits down, and he's you know, he's mad. He's still pissed off about the guy that's, why was he heckling me? And Dad comes over to him, and he puts his hand around his shoulder, you know, and he goes, "Riley," you know, he goes, "I'll tell you what," he goes, "I think I'm going to go out there, and I'm going to make a special announcement about what just happened to you." And Riley says, "You know, that's a good idea, Edward." And that was my dad's name before he changed his name to Buddy Fuller. He said, "That's a good idea, Edward." Dad says, yeah, "I'm going to do it." He says, "I'm going to go out there and announce that, by God, you'll beat the shit out of any cripple in the house." Oh, kind of like the joking days, you know, it didn't take much to get a laugh back in those days. Guys were kind of looking for something to laugh about because times were tough. Tex Riley, before I go on and get to the next story, Tex Riley died in the same town with a heart attack that Ray Gunkel died in, Savannah, Georgia, in 1966. And then Ray died there in 1972, I think it was.
Did Tex die in the ring also?
Tex died in the ring, just like Ray Gunkel. You know, Ray actually went to the dressing room. Tex died in the ring. And Tex was a great guy, great friend of my dad's and my grandfather especially. He was one of Roy's staples as a babyface. He was an extremely talented wrestler and a good shooter as well, as most guys were. So now the next one I want to tell is the same kind of time frame, just about. My dad's over there promoting in Arkansas and Missouri, parts of Missouri, and he has to cross the Mississippi River, and he rides with my granddad, Roy. And Roy and Dad had a very odd relationship, kind of as I had with my dad, as a matter of fact, but they didn't have the greatest relationship. And Roy had been traveling. He drove all the time, all over the South. And he told Dad, he said, they were nearing the Mississippi River. And the river flooded certain times of the year. And when it did, the land was so flat next to the Mississippi River that the flood would run maybe 15 miles sometimes inland from the river itself. And so Roy said, "Bunyan," he called Dad Bunyan. He never called him Edward. He never called him his real name. He said, "Bunyan, I want you to drive for me some." So Dad says, yeah. And Dad was like a big kid. He was maybe 18, 20, maybe 22 years old. He's young. And he's all, yeah, okay. Yeah. Like the movies, like the cartoons. And he gets behind the wheel, and Roy starts, he lays over against the window, and then he leans up and he goes, "Now, Bunyan," he goes, "we're headed over toward the river here." And he goes, It's gonna be slick. The water's gonna be up. You can be expecting it. Then you need to be careful." Dad's like, yeah, I got it. You know, so Roy leans over with his head against the window, and Dad says, he tells me the story. He says, I'm running about 75 miles an hour. And he goes, there was no hills. He said, you know, you just, you looked ahead and the road's all clean and everything. And he says, man, I'm rolling like crazy about 75. And I said, I start up this little hill. He says, maybe only 30 feet high, you know? And he said, when I reached the top of it, he said, there was the Mississippi River. So he said, the water had receded. The water had run up to almost the top of the hill, but it had receded back, maybe, he said, a couple of hundred feet from the top of the hill, so that it just left the mud on the highway. So he said, there he was going 75 miles an hour, and he tops the hill, and gosh, there's the water, and there's the mud, and he slams on his brakes. And he said, here they went. He said, we spun around. We were going 70 miles an hour in one direction and spinning like a top while we were doing it. And he said, Roy just hung on to the car side of the car door. And he said, he didn't say anything. He said, finally, he said, guys, I was just begging the car, stop, please stop. Don't stop in the water. Please stop. And he said, finally, the stock car stopped. He said, the water was about up halfway up the doors. And he said, Roy just kind of looked over at him. And he said, what did I tell you, Bunyan, about the river? Dad goes, oh, God, well, you know, I guess I didn't listen too good. So, you know, they had a strange relationship. Anyway, they go to the town that Dad's promoting. And so Roy's letting him promote, him try his hand to promote some towns. I guess he puts out the cards and he hires the announcer and he hires all the people. And he has a wrestler on the card who was a heel back in the 40s and 50s. His name was Red Roberts. He was bald-headed. Rowdy Red Roberts, they called him. And so Dad wrote out the card for his announcer to announce. Red Roberts always went to the ring, just took a towel with him. Used to be the fuck, you know, it was the way it was back in the days. You know, everybody just kind of, somebody carried towels. Some guys took nothing to the ring, didn't even wear jackets. But so he carried his towel to the ring, as he always did. And he got in the ring, and the guy introduced his opponent. And then he started to read to introduce Red Roberts. And the guy wasn't familiar with Red Roberts. He'd not seen him in the town before, the announcer. And he starts, ladies and gentlemen, in this corner to my right from Jackson, Tennessee, that you all know him, One Ball Roberts. Instead of Red Roberts, Dad had written and the guy couldn't read it. So he called him One Ball Robert. So Red Roberts drops his towel in the middle of the ring. He's like, oh, my God almighty, what did he call me? You know, so Dad, Roy's in the town with him. It's the same trip. Roy's like, oh, wow. He goes, hey, Bunyan, what did you give the announcer to announce? Well, you know, look at it. It says Red Roberts. Well, no, look at it. It says, looks like it says One Ball to me. So, it was so then to make matters worse, things were going pretty bad for Dad. That night, they didn't have a bell to ring. So there was no way they could ring a bell. So the guy found an old bucket and he went outside and got a big rock and put it in the bucket. So Roy's wrestling on the card for Dad. And he's in the last match. And they go a 2-out-of-3-fall match. And then right at the end, they go Broadway. They go through. So there's no winner. But at the end of the match, Roy's a baby face, and they're about to win the match. And all of a sudden, the guy gets up, the time limit's out, and he's got no bell. And he takes the bucket, and he starts shaking the bucket with the big rock in it. And it's going, doo 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 doo. It don't sound like a bell or anything else. And so Roy leaves the ring, and the people are all around him. They're all excited. Oh, what a great match and everything. And then he says, Roy tells Dad, he says, and you know what somebody said to me? Dad said, no, Dad was already his head down. This is just going to bury me further, I'm sure. He goes, what did they say? And he said, I heard somebody say, you know, Roy, you'd have won the match if I hadn't rung the bucket. God, I mean, it was like, Dad had a real difficult time getting through those type of deals, man. I got one more story I want to tell about my dad. This happened. I was 12 years old. We're living in Memphis. Dad's a big star. He has gone to Memphis in 1958, and by 1959, early 60, Memphis is one of the biggest wrestling cities in America, still is today if it was still running. It was for many, many years, and everybody knew him. So, and he didn't, he was the promoter for the first couple of years, and then he finally wrestled in the town. He got to be pretty famous. And we went, him and my mom and my brother and I, Rob, and we went to dinner at the nicest steakhouse in town. It was called Jim's Steakhouse. And we get into the steakhouse, and we're sitting there eating, the four of us at a table. Next to us is two businessmen, dressed really nice. My mom was a very pretty lady, and one of those guys is stupid enough to be flirting with her. You know, he just happens to be sitting where he's across from where she is. And Dad picks up on it. You know, I didn't pick up on it. I'm 12 years old. My brother's a year younger than I am. And I see Dad, you know, he looks that direction a couple of times. And then all of a sudden he just gets up and he goes over. And they're wearing suits, both of them, two guys. So he reaches down and he grabs one of the guy that's been doing the flirting, by the lapels of his suit. Obviously, he reaches in and gets enough of his shirt, too, to be able to jerk him out of his seat. And he jerks him straight up in the air, really high, like you would choke a guy if you had his throat and you put him over your head and you're holding him up there choking. He had him that high. And then he slammed him right in his steak. He had a brand new suit on. He had a beautiful suit on. And wham, the table of food went everywhere. Everybody in the restaurant, they turn around, they look, you know, and then Dad takes his thumb and he sticks it in the guy's throat, and he puts his face right up to his ear, you know, he's at another table. Well, I can't hear what he's saying. Nobody can hear what he's saying. And he whispers something in the guy's ear. So, and then he just leaves the guy. Now the guy's still sitting in his steak, and he walks back and sits down and starts eating his own steak. And the guy sits there. And, you know, and I'm a big kid. I'm like, what the hell? I mean, why ain't he getting up? You know, the guy just sat there and we kept eating maybe for 10 minutes. His buddy sat down there. He wouldn't eat his steak. And he's just sitting there looking at his friend. He didn't say anything to each other. They were like as quiet as church mouse. So after we finished eating, this was probably 15, 20 minutes later. Guy's still sitting in his steak. And we get up and we get our check and we leave. So we get in the car and I asked Dad, I said, what did you say to him? And he said, I told him, if you get out of this steak before I get up and leave, I'm going to come back and do a hell of a lot worse to you. So, I mean, you know, that was kind of his style. He was kind of quiet about it. You know, I don't know what they did. I'm sure the guy that owned the restaurant apologized to my dad. You know, instead of being angry about it, he was like, I'm sorry that happened. Sorry you had to do something like that. So, you know, it just showed you the respect people had for wrestlers back in those days. Sometimes guys got away with crazy stuff. And we'll talk a little more about my granddad and his brother. He had two brothers, Herb and Jack Welch, both about the same age. Roy was the oldest, but they were all within 4 or 5 years of him. He had trained them to wrestle, and they were darn good wrestlers, too, especially Herb, who was world junior heavyweight champion for 5 years at a stretch one time. So, you know, very, very good wrestlers. And they messed with the, you know, they were wrestlers. So when they went to towns, they had girlfriends in pretty much every town. It was the way it was back in those days. And this guy, they had one wrestler that wrestled for him that was really henpecked. And they ribbed him all the time. He said, God, man, you need to tell your wife, you know, you ain't going to be home on a certain time. And they finally talked him in. They said, why don't you just go to this such and such town with us? It was about 2 hours away from where it's home. And they said, you know, we'll bring you back on time, but you need to get away from your wife. You don't need to travel by yourself. You need to have some fun. So the guy's like, oh, now you know, if I go now, you are going to get me back home on time. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. They're both. Oh, yeah, we'll get you back home. Don't worry about it. You'll be back home on time. So he rides with him. And sure enough, they get him on the road. After the matches is over, they don't go home. They get a couple of girls and they go out to a restaurant and they have a little dinner and then they're hanging out. And he's looking at his watch. Oh, and he's saying, hey, my wife, I told my wife I'd be home by 1 o'clock, and it's already 1 o'clock, and it's a 2-hour drive. And you know what? We got to go. Oh, we'll be okay. We'll hang out a little longer. And they just kept putting it off. So they finally get him in the car, and they start back to his home, which was in Dyersburg, Tennessee, wrestling capital of the world back in those days. It was where Roy set up his original office in the Tennessee Territory and trained so many wrestlers, it was ridiculous. But anyway, they go back to Dyersburg. And when they get to his house on the way back, Herb gets in the back seat, puts the guy in the front seat, and he has a tube of lipstick he's gotten from one of the girls that they had been hanging out at the restaurant with. And he took that lipstick and he put it on the inside of his middle finger and his first finger on his left of your hand, on your right hand. Then as they were driving along, coming back, the guy kept going, oh, God, she's just going to kill me. My wife is going to kill me when I get there. You guys have just got me in such trouble. And Herb would reach up there, guy held on a white shirt, and he would take his fingers and he would put them on the guy's collar. And he would squeeze them together and he'd say, oh, it's going to be all right. And when he'd take his fingers off, it looked just like lipstick, like some woman had been kissing him. And then he would do it to the side of his neck. He would do it all over different places on his shirt. And the guy never noticed what was really going on. And then when they pulled up to the guy's house, Herb laid down in the back seat, rolled the windows down. And the guy got out and his wife, there it was. Roy's driving. He says, I could see the guy. He's standing, his wife standing in the window waiting on him. Said she opened the door before he even got there. You know, and he said, when he got there, she looked. First thing she saw was that lipstick all over his shirt. And he said she started cussing him. You son of a bitch. You know, she was really, I'm going to kill her. Boy, she was just giving him hell. And he says, Herb leaned up so that she could hear him. And he went and tried to use his best woman voice. And he said, we'll see you next week, baby. And Roy backed out, and they left that poor son of a gun there with his wife ready to beat the hell out of him, man. It was kind of the thing that the guys did back in those days, that everybody that was in the business had a good time, but they sure as heck made it difficult for themselves for the other people. They take another guy as an example. He's in a hotel. And this guy's a guy that likes to have fun. He was looking for women all the time. And in this case, he had found somebody and he had gone and got a hotel room. And so they knew, Roy and Herb, who he was going to take back to the room with him. And they knew she was married. So they got her off to the side and they concocted a little story for this guy, this poor son of a gun that's taken her to the hotel room. So he takes her to the room. And, you know, they've just gotten there, hadn't been in the room very long. And all of a sudden, there's a bang, bang, bang on the door. And the woman says, he's the registered. The guy's registered under his name. So he says, who is it? And he says, I'm such and such. And he goes, is my wife in there? And so the guy goes, no, your wife ain't in here, you know. Are you sure my wife isn't in there? No. He's saying no. And he's trying to back into the closet. I mean, into the bathroom. And he says, no, your wife's not here. And the guy says, oh, bullshit. He goes, I got my gun and I'm on my way in that door, son. And he backs off and kicks the door open. So the wrestler runs into the bathroom. Well, back in those days, all he had was those big old huge iron claw tubs. And so the guy's in and out of the bedroom area of the, and you know, he's screaming, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill you. And the wrestler picks up the big claw tub and he runs through the bathroom wall that goes out into the hallway. Just the tub and all, just busts a big hole in the wall, goes through into the hallway, starts running down the hallway. And, they get to hear the next story the next day from the woman about, boy, what a really good rib that was. You know, it's hard to imagine that you could get away with things like that, but they sure as hell got away with that kind of stuff consistently back in the day. Roy was nuts. He he was, as he got older, me and my brother got up to about 15, 16 years old. Roy's probably in his 50s, maybe 60 years old. And he tells us, we live in Mississippi. He says, do you guys ever see any rattlesnakes down there where you are? And so we go, yeah, we've got some rattlesnakes there. We've seen them before. He says, I'll tell you what. He says, I want a live rattlesnake. He says, I'll give y'all $25 for a live rattlesnake. You catch him and bring him back here to Tennessee. He lived in Tennessee, in Yorkville, just outside Dyersburg. We lived in northern part of Mississippi. So we catch a rattlesnake. We're lucky enough to find a rattler, and we're able to catch him, and we put him in a five-gallon bucket. And about a week later, we go back to Roy's farm, Big Dairy, and Roy's there, and we tell him, we had the rattler in a five-gallon bucket with a big board over the top of it in the trunk of the Cadillac. My dad had a Cadillac. And we get there, and we go running for Roy, man. Roy, we got something for you. He comes out there. He said, what you got? He said, we got a rattler, man. Oh, yeah, guys, boy, he's all excited. So we go around, open the trunk. And I'd never seen anybody catch a snake like this before. I could see how experienced Roy was with handling snakes and bad snakes at that. And this rattler was huge. He was probably 6 feet long and 6 inches thick. And it had 12 rattlers and a button on him. I mean, he was a bad snake. And so we opened the trunk for him, and he took the bucket and set it out on the ground. It still had the big board on top of it. Well, we backed up, man, we don't know what that snake's going to come after you. No, what those deals. We're a little scared for Roy, which was ridiculous, because he was much badder than a snake to begin with. And so he reached down and pulled the top off of the bucket, and he just kicked the bucket over sideways. And the rattler came out. Well, the rattler was ready to coil. He was trying to coil, but Roy was so fast, he just reached down. He never hesitated. He reached and grabbed him right behind the head. I mean, I watched it, and I was like, oh, my God, if he had been the 2 inches further one direction or the other, or he'd have missed his head, he's going to get bit. And so he had him. He had that big rattler. And he said, y'all want to see something funny? So I said, yeah, heck yeah. What are you going to do with him? He said, come on. So he had a big old dairy. So we had a big milk barn out there. He took him out in the milk barn, the big rattler. And he had a needle and thread. And he sewed his mouth shut right there in front of us. We watched him sew his mouth shut. And we were like, God, dog, what are you going to do with him? And he says, I got three wrestlers traveling with me tomorrow. And he goes, I'm going to throw him in my Cadillac. So he throws this live rattlesnake with his mouth sewn together in the backseat of his Cadillac and closes the door and leaves him in there for a whole day. Next afternoon, he leaves to go to the town. And I'm a big kid. I'm about 16 years old at this point, 15. I go, wow, man. Can I go? He goes, hell no. I only got the room for four. And he goes, I said, well, what are you going to do? He goes, well, I'm going to drive like I always do, which meant he was going to drive 120 miles an hour down the middle of the road. And he said, I'm going to drive like I always do. And he says, oh, we'll have some fun. So he took off with that rattler in his car. And I couldn't see where the rattlesnake was, but he was underneath the front seat. So anyway, and Roy came back the next night, that night, 3 in the morning. I had those long trips. And next morning, first thing I went to ask him, what happened? What happened? What went on? And he goes, well, it's pretty funny. He says, I got her up to about 120, 130. And he goes, he said, the damn snake, he said, he wouldn't rattle. He said, I couldn't get him to crank up, you know? And so he said, I had to tell a story. He said, I told a little story. And he said, at the end of the story, he said, I laughed. He said, the rest of them didn't even laugh too big at my story. But he said, it gave me a good reason. He said, I reached down there and I slapped that seat right over top of that rattler. And he said, all of a sudden, that boy cranked up. And I could just imagine now a Cadillac and you're running 130 miles an hour and a rattlesnake is underneath the front seat. And, you know, rattlers don't sound like any other snake. None of them make that kind of sound. So that snake cranked up. And I said, what did they do? And he said, He said they had all their doors open. They had one leg out. I said, did you slow down? He said, no, I sped up. I was like, oh, my gosh, almighty, man. Running down the road in a Cadillac 140 miles an hour. And three guys about to jump out, and you got a live rattlesnake in there. You know, I was really surprised that they didn't, one of them, at least, they just didn't bail out, you know. So, you know, he was just crazy, my granddad. I got probably 1,000 stories about him, but he was a character. He used to have what they called him and Herb called car fights. And, you know, I was a big kid, about the same age, high school. And you know, I rode a trip with him, you know, and they said, you know, you ever have a car fight, kid? I said, what do you mean a car fight? And he goes, oh, geez. He goes, you know, wrestlers we used to drive around 20, 30 years ago in them old Model Ts. And he goes, we'd have car fights. You know, he said, guys couldn't make it to get to the town before they had to fight or do something. He said, they'd get in fight on the road. And so I said, are you serious? I mean, you know, they're going to fight. They're going to wrestle. I mean, can't they wait? And he goes, oh, no. Most of the time, you never get there before you'd have at least one or two car fights. And I said, well, what kind of car fight did you have? And so they got to telling me about one. It was back in the days in the early 50s. They used to sell gas. And gas was 5 cents a gallon. Gas was cheap. And if you bought a full tank of gas, you get a dozen plates. And they had bought a full tank of gas for his car. And they had put the plates in the back seat of the window. And he said that there was a guy in the back seat, and Roy was driving, and Herb was sitting in the passenger seat. And they got into a little argument, Roy and the guy in the seat behind him. And the guy was stupid enough. He said, Roy said, you know, we got a little argument. And he said, the guy reached up there and he slapped me in the side of the head. You know, and he said, hard enough that it made my other side of my head hit the car door. You know, and he said, made me mad, a little mad. It's like, oh, boy. he said, we were running about 70 miles, 80 miles an hour. And he goes, all of a sudden, he goes, as soon as he slapped me, he said, I just started walking. I said, I got my feet on the steering wheel and then up on top of the car. And he said, I basically walked over on top of that sumbitch in the back seat. And so he said, Herb just slid over, kept the car going. We never even got down to 50 miles an hour. Herb got to ride back up to 80. And he said, I got him in the best place you can get a guy in a car fight. I said, well, where is that? And he says, on his back in the back floorboard. He said, he's dead meat then if that happens to him. So I was like, goodness gracious. Now I could see this, you know, he's on top of him pounding it. And I said, well, did you beat how bad did you beat him up? And he said, well, he said, I didn't want to hurt my hands too bad. He goes, I got to work at night. He said, but I had those dozen plates up there in the window. He said, I'll reach up there and get one of those plates and smash it over his face, break the plate in his face. And then he said, I got another one. He said, by God, you know, he said, my wife liked to have those plates, but he said, I didn't get home with a single one of them. I broke all dozen of them in his face. And he said, he's a pretty bloody guy. I was like, oh, my goodness. I'm thinking like, wow, what is that kind of stuff all about? He said they used to have car fights, and because he was the promoter and he had trained a lot of those guys, that he would just pull over. When they got into a car fight, he didn't want to tear his car up. He'd just pull off the side of the road and open the doors and jerk whoever's fighting out and let them go to it. And I said, well, how did you stop them? And he goes, well, you knew when to stop them. And I said, well, how did you know when to stop them? And he'd say, well, you could see. He goes, you know, they get a little bloody. And he said, then they kind of slow down a little bit, you know, they back off. And he says, you know, now they're getting a little winded and they're blowing up a little bit. And I said, well, how did you stop them? And he said, I would just go, time, just like a bell. He said, like ringing the bell, time. And he said, they drop their hand. And he said, most of the time they get right back in the car, sit down beside each other, bloody as hell. He goes, ride the rest of the trip. He goes, sometimes I'd pull over and let them wash off in a little creek or something, get the blood off of them. This says a lot about what the wrestling business was like back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, and the way those guys were and how hard they and difficult they were at just going off on each other, just fighting for no reason. Couldn't make it to towns without having to fight.
You know, Ron, they could have rung the bucket instead of just saying time.
Yeah, he should have had a bucket in his car. You know, I'm surprised he didn't have a bucket with a rock in it in the trunk, and he could have rung the bucket on him, you know. But, yeah, they didn't have the bucket there. So I'm going to tell you, let's change gears a little bit. I'm going to tell a few stories about naked wrestlers. You know, I don't know if you guys, I know you've heard of him, Don Fargo. You know, I mean, he's one of the classic old-time wrestlers of all time.
One of the fabulous Fargos.
There you go. Jackie Fargo, Don Fargo, Roughhouse Fargo, you know, and as far as Memphis was concerned. But Jackie and Don Fargo were a fantastic team in the 40s, 50s, 60s, on into the 70s. Actually, Don Fargo wrestled into the damn 80s. Don was in great shape, and Don loved to get naked. He just had a thing about him that he wasn't happy if he had to have all his clothes on. So I remember being in the car with a guy that was running Gulf Coast. When I bought the Gulf Coast territory in 1978, I was riding with Rocky McGuire, who they had running one end of that territory. And Don Fargo was in the crew when I was there going and seeing a few of the towns before I bought and paid my money for the territory. I wanted to see what the towns looked like and the buildings and that type of do a little due diligence. So we're in a car behind Don Fargo, and he's in a car with another wrestler, and it's a big RV. So we go into Dothan, Alabama, and in Dothan, Alabama, there's a circle. They call it the circle, as a matter of fact. It goes around the city, and it's two-lane roads now. I mean, now it's a four-lane road, but back in those days, it was a two-lane road. And so we're following with Fargo and this guy in the RV in front of us. And they pull up to a red light. Right gets red in front of them, and we stop behind them. And as soon as we stop, Don Fargo jumps out of the RV, and he's totally nude. He bends over, and he checks the tire pressure on the first tire, the right front tire. Then he comes to the right back tire, and then he goes to the left back tire. And there's cars everywhere. People everywhere, and then he goes to the front left tire. So basically, he takes the light turns green, and he goes back around and gets in the car. And you know, me and Rocky McGuire are sitting in the car, and Rocky goes, "Oh God, Ron!" He goes, "Look, there's one of my champions." I was like, "Aren't you proud?" Wow, does he do that all? Is that the way he checks tires all the time? So, you know, Don was just he just loved to do that stuff. So one night, years later, I bought the territory in 1978. And in 1980, I'm riding back from Dothan on a Saturday night. We ran Dothan on Saturdays back in that time frame to Pensacola, Florida, where all the wrestlers live. And Don Fargo's in the car with a bunch of heels. I'm a babyface at this point. And Don's in the car with the heels. And they're up. They leave before I do, and I catch them on the freeway, Interstate 10, going through northern Florida along the panhandle there. And they're running probably 75, 80 miles an hour, and I'm running 90. So I start gaining on them, and I see they're all raising hell on the inside like something's going on. And then the car's swerving back and forth. I'm thinking, what the hell are they doing? And I get up to where the front of the car is, and Don Fargo is laying on the hood of the car naked. He's holding on to the hood where it connects to the windshield. And his body is swinging halfway off the car. When he'd swing one direction, his legs would come off one side of the car and then the other side of the car. And all the guys in the car are screaming and laughing like hell, and Fargo's laughing like hell. And I'm past him. I'm like, oh my God, he's gonna get killed, man. You know, I mean, it was just absolutely nuts about how some guys were just so far out there. Don just alone had to get naked, even if it had to crawl out on the hood of a car at 90 miles an hour. He didn't give a damn if he could take all his clothes off. my granddad's brother, Herb, Johnny Walker, Wrestling 2. Most everybody knows who Wrestling 2 was. Wrestling 2, prior to being Wrestling 2, a long time before he was Wrestling 2, they called him Rubber Man, Johnny Walker. And he had ability to, his joints were, could dislocate his joints, and he could put his body in all these odd shapes and stuff. And Herb didn't like him. Herb didn't. Johnny at this point was young, and he was not a great worker yet. He's a long way from being Wrestling too. And he would go out, and he wasn't even on the card sometimes, and he would just get in the ring and put on shows and dislocate his joints and stick his arms behind his head and do all these crazy maneuvers. And Herb hated to Herb watched that show, and Herb had a horrible, horrible distaste for Johnny Walker. So one night they're working in the town, and the town had a stage where they had a big curtain across the front of the stage. And Johnny Walker went out and sat down. He sat down naked and crossed his legs like he was an Indian or something, and sat there I don't know what he was doing. Herb didn't either, obviously, but Herb watched him. You know, Herb said, I knew they were going to open the curtain to the stage at some point. And he goes, I had a plan for him. I said, well, Herb, what was that plan? And he goes, you know, about bell time. He said, the bell rang, and he said, it's his first time there. And he didn't know what the system was here. You know, he didn't know what they normally did, and he wasn't expecting it. And he said, they opened up the curtain. So I said, well, what did Johnny do? And he said, Johnny sit there because, you know, he's at least sitting down and they can't really see he's naked. And I said, well, what did you do? And he said, I wanted to see him. I wanted to let him see he was naked. So I said, well, what'd you do? And he said, I ran and got him by the back of the neck and by his ass. And he said, I ran him straight across the stage like a vaudeville act. Right? And he said, the crowd cheered. Whoa, hey. And I said, what happened then? He said, they all screamed. They said, bring him back, Herb. And he said, I ran him back naked across the stage. It was just crazy how things got, you know, guys back in those days did not care, man. They went to have a good time every night, and they did. And it was kind of like that even back into my day. But back in those days, it was even more so that way. Fargo, got another couple of Fargo stories. Fargo came to visit us, and this is 1966. My dad has gotten into the promotion in Atlanta, and he owns part of the Atlanta operation. 64, we went there. Atlanta was dead. By 66, he was drawing 30,000 plus in outside baseball stadiums. I mean, he had set Atlanta on fire. And Don Fargo is one of the guys in the crew. Fargo had a great body. We lived on a farm, a ranch, basically, had a lot of horses. And those horses were roping horses, and you know they were used to cut. We had cows, and we roped cows, and we rode dog steers, and rode bulls, and I mean we did just about everything the rodeo guys did. And Fargo came out; he didn't know a damn thing about riding a horse or anything else. And that day, Dad put him on a horse and got him riding around in the rodeo arena. He had the horse running, and Fargo was. He was nuts. He was crazy. He would do anything. So Don had that horse running full speed, and Dad was on his horse, and he had a rope on his horse. So he just tied the rope to his saddle horn, and Don Fargo came by at full speed, and Dad just roped him. His horse was standing still, and it jerked Fargo off. Fargo turned an entire somersault and landed on his belly. And bounced, bam, 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 and the smoke went, cloud of dust went everywhere. And I thought, oh, God, man, Fargo's going to get up. He's going to be mad. We're going to have a problem here, right? Dad better be ready. And Fargo took him a second to get up. He got his bearings about him. He got up, and me and my brother watching, looking at each other like, what the hell's going to happen here? And Fargo looked at the old man. He went, ha, damn, he said, give me that horse. He got back on the horse and he said, do it again. I mean, what kind of idiot wants to do that? Take that kind of a bump. When one time ain't enough, he goes around and does it again. That same day, I got a bunch of young guys out visiting me, and I've just started working out. Joe Scarpa, Jay Strongbow. Before he becomes Jay Strongbow, Joe Scarpa is a good friend of mine. He lives just down the road from us, and he came and spent a lot of time. He was a great athlete, Joe Scarpa, and he played. He was a football player. He could do anything. He was a tremendous athlete, and he had taught me how to work out. Well, Fargo's there now. Fargo was really big time body. He didn't do any steroids. There was no steroids in those days. He was just a heavy lifter. And we went into the little barn where I had my gym, and all these boys followed. And Don wanted to see my workout gym. Hey, yeah, I took him in there, and he says, well, you don't got much weight here, kid. And, you know, and said, no. And he goes, let me show you guys a couple of things. So he said, let me do you a bench press. And I had an old wooden bench. It was horrible. It was going to collapse if he'd have just put his body at 240 pounds or so. On there, that bench would have collapsed, much less any weight on there. So, and he recognized that, and he goes, oh, that bench ain't going to work. So he looked around. There's a concrete block, just a regular concrete block like you build a house with. He put that concrete block there. He reached over and got a horse pad where we used to put on horses, and he laid it on the concrete block. He laid down there, and I gave him the regular 45-pound bar, a big old Olympic-sized bar, and he says, how much weight you got? And I said, I don't know, maybe 300 pounds. And he goes, put everything you got on it. And all these boys, they'd never seen anything like this before. They were like, they started reaching and grabbing weights. We were throwing these 45-pound plates on this bar, just packing that bar out. It got up there to everything. We literally put every weight we had that would fit on a bar on that bar. And Fargo pumped out 10 reps of bench presses. Like those boys their mouths just dropped open. Like, wow, did you see that? And then he said, take it. Told us to take it, you know, because we didn't have a rack to put it on. So we got it out of his hands and set it down. And he got right up and he jumped on the dip rack. And he looked down there and it was a bunch of dumbbells. He said, what's the biggest dumbbell you got? And I said, 60s. And he said, he crossed his legs and he said, put them between my legs. The 60-pound dumbbell. Now, he had just done 10 reps with 300-plus benches, and he jumped up there on that dip rack. I put that 60-pound dumbbell between his legs. He did 20 dips. Those boys counted 15, 16, 17, and they were looking at me like, God, this guy's unbelievable. He got to 20, and he just dropped that, and he just walked out of the gym, basically walked out of the barn, and, you know. And what an impression he left on those young boys, though, man. I mean, he was a hoss, man. Really, really a big, strong son of a gun. Back in the day, he was something to deal with back in that time frame. There's a lot of other guys got stories about. Some of them back in my dad's days. We move a little forward into the 50s, 60s. Mario Galinto. I don't know how many people know Mario Galinto out there listening, but Mario Galinto was a superstar, and he was a wild son of a gun. He had the long black hair. He was in movies. He had done a whole lot of things in his life. He had written books, and he was in movies, and he was tough. He was in tremendous shape, and he was very noticeable, recognizable. You know, I mean, nobody looked like he did. He had earrings long before guys had earrings. And, you know, he was, dad would pay back in those days, $25 to wrestlers that would let somebody hardway them. He didn't want guys using blades. And he said, I want hardways. If you'll get, let them bust you a hard way and you let me see the hole or the stitches, you know, I'll give you $25. And he told me about this as a kid. You know, he didn't ever tell me what the business was about as a kid. But later he said, you know, I used to pay $25 for a hard way. And I was like, dang, man, how many guys would do that in a week? And he said, Mario Galinto would collect 125 to 150 at the end of every week. He would do four or five hard ways a week. You know, I mean, he just had his eyes were all busted and scarred up. And there's pictures in my stud cast of him and Dad after having matches with Dad in which they both hard weighed each other. 40,000 fans in Mobile, Alabama, 30,000, almost 40,000 in Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, they just and they look like they had been in car wrecks after those matches. So Mario was so damn tough that he would go and he'd have these hard ways. He would be sewn up. He'd have to be sewn up every once in a while. And a lot of times he wouldn't be sewn up. Dad told me one time he was working with him and he reached down to grab him by the hair to pull him up off the mat. And he said, when he pulled his hair, he said, the hair, his scalp's separated because somebody had hit him with a chair the night before. And he hadn't got it sewed up, so his head opened up, and he could see his skull, the top of his skull. He was like, oh, my God, man, what are you all about? So Mario went with another wrestler one night. He got busted, and he went to get it sewn up. And so he got there, and the doctor says, okay, wait a minute. We're going to get the Novocaine here, and we'll do. And Mario says, I don't need any Novocaine. The doctor laughed. The wrestler says, told me the story. He said, the doctor laughed. He said, oh, my, please, you know you need Novocaine. And Mario says, no, I don't need any Novocaine. He said, just sew it up. And the doctor says, oh, come on. And, you know, he said, this went on for about 5-10 minutes. And he said, finally, the doctor got upset. He got mad. He said, okay, you really think you can tank? And he said he sewed Mario up. And he said, Mario never even looked up. He said he never made a move, never flinched, nothing. He said, it was just like he had Novocaine. He said that doctor, when he left, said, you are the beanest, baddest guy I've ever seen in my life. So, Mario would get heat and have these matches back in Dad's day, and they had an arena outside in Pensacola, Florida, and they had a riot that night, and everybody had left. The police had forced most of the people to leave, and Dad stayed late, because he was in the last match with Mario, and Mario was still in the dressing room. And he said, a guy, after everybody had left, pulled back up. And he said, behind the arena, the little outdoor arena, there was a gate back there, the fence, and you had to go down about the 50 yards to get to the opening of the fence in order to get out to where your car parked. And he said, my car and Mario's car was there, and then this guy pulled up. And he said, Mario came out of the dressing room, and he said the guy looked over there and saw him, and he said he had a tire tool in one hand and a knife in the other. And he says, I've come back for you, Mario. He goes, I'm going to cut your guts out and then bash your brains in. Dad's in the dressing room. He could see what's going through the window in the dressing room. And Mario, instead of, you know, like, I don't know about today's guys, whether they would handle that. They certainly wouldn't handle it like Mario did. He said, Mario told the guy, he said, wait right there. Like, oh, I can't wait. And he said he took off running. He had to run down to get through the gate in order to get around to get back to the guy. And he said, because he kept screaming as he was running, wait for me, please. And he said, when Mario went around the gate and started back toward the guy, he said, the guy jumped in his car, boy, threw his tire tool in there and his knife, and he started his car around and screamed off out of there. Mario had nothing. He didn't have anything to protect himself with. And the guy's just horrified of him, just went, you know, racing out of town to keep from having to deal with a guy who had nothing. He had a knife and a tire tool. You know,
sometimes it pays to have that reputation, huh, Ron?
Oh, man. I mean, you know, and they earned it. Guys like that earned it. People knew how bad they were. And, you know, when you got those hard ways all the time and you're walking around town all over different cities, it's the best advertisement you can have for wrestling being real. People damn sure believed it then because of my dad, like I say, was paying $25 to get them. And guys were willing to do it. They were doing it pretty often. In the stud cast that we do, the current one, 135, 136, we're talking about Ron Wright getting busted the hard way by the superstars. And, you know, it was what happened. And it's what had to happen to really make fans believe that what they were seeing was real. And one more Mario story. He goes into a bar, and I bought the territory, the Gulf Coast territory, from the Fields brothers, Lee, Bobby, and Don Fields, in 1978. And they had been stars there from 1958, 55, 56. They went there in 56. They stayed there and then bought Dad out in 58 and stayed there until I came and bought them out in 78, 20 years later. And those guys were famous all along the Gulf Coast down there. And so Mario goes into a bar, and everybody knows who Mario is, too, because nobody looks like Mario. And some guy in there gets to started with him about the wrestling's all fake. Yeah, you know, that stuff's all fake. It's all phony. And Mario's trying, you know, not to have a problem. Hey, go away, man. Leave me alone. Yeah, yeah, y'all are doing this. Y'all do that. And you just, that ain't real blood. The whole deal. So finally, Mario hammerlocks him. And he takes him down in the floor of the bar. And everybody backs off naturally, right? The guy starts screaming. I mean, Mario's cranking his arm like he's pumping a well to get water out of it. I mean, just back and forth. And I mean, he's breaking the guy's arm. the guy's letting everybody know that he's breaking my arm. And he's screaming like crazy. And Mario starts going, God, he goes, you're great. He goes, you're better than them Fields boys. Ah, dang, we need to get you booked, guy. You'd be super, man. That was a strange, that was the way those guys were. They didn't always beat people up and beat them to death. They had a good time. They made fun of people, and they knew how to make a point and get the job done at the same time. Pretty amazing that the things that they were able to do. I want to tell people one about back before they had metal rings, back in the 50s. Even early 60s, I can remember wooden rings actually as far as into the 70s. All rings were made out of wood, obviously, before they started making them out of metal. And my dad made one of the first metal rings out of 4 by 4 inch by 4 inch tube steel, and fabulous rings that made a lot of noise, and you could take bigger bumps in them, and you didn't get hurt as often, and they were just better for wrestling. It sounded really good. It made the fans think that, God, these bumps are just killing them, killing guys. But I saw my dad wrestle a guy named Baby Blimp, who came from Dyersburg, Tennessee, where Roy had, which was the capital of wrestling in the world back in the 30s and 40s. And Baby Blimp wrestled in the 50s, 60s, 70s, even up to maybe around 1980 before he died. A big guy, 300 plus pounds. And I saw my dad wrestle him in a wooden ring one night. Can't remember what city it was, but I was a big kid. And I remember Dad picked him up toward the end of the match, and he slammed him in the middle of the ring. And they had 2x6s that ran across the center of the ring underneath the ring. And they broke one of the 2x6s. And when he slammed him and he hit on the mat, you could hear this, you could tell that something cracked underneath the ring. So Bunk, that was his name, his real name. Everybody called him Bunk. Bunk got scared, you know, and so he said, don't slam me anymore. So Dad picked him up and slammed him right away. Same spot. You know, this time it went a bigger crack. And, you know, oh, and then Bunk's trying like, oh, my God, he's trying to get up. But the ring started to sag a little bit where the board had cracked. So Dad picked him up again. He slammed him right in the same spot. Now he cracked the next 2x6. Another big crack. Now Bunk's body half disappeared. You can only see half of him. He's down. He's going through the mat, basically. So Dad reaches and drags him out of the hole that he's in now and slams him in the hole. That time, he totally disappeared. Now he's a 300-pounder. He's, you know, he's 4 feet thick. And his whole body is gone. He's gone. It's like Dad ain't wrestling anybody. The people in the building went crazy, like, oh, my God, where is he? So, you know, crazy stuff used to happen back in those days that would never happen again. But, you know, guys, and Bunk was just horrified of anything like that. They scared to death of any of that type of stuff. Charlie Carr, guy named trained me. Name was Charlie Carr. He trained my dad. He wrestled with my grandfather back in the 30s. One of the old timers and one of the great old timers of all time, a tremendous shooter. He taught me so much as a kid of how to hurt people, and he was really, really good at it. And Charlie was a tremendous wrestler, a great showman, but a much better skilled at shooting. He was a tremendous shooter. And he stayed in a hotel downtown Mobile, and they loved him in the hotel. He was a big fan there. You know, the people that owned the hotel were fans of Charlie. I guess that's a good way of putting it. And Charlie had a wife early in life, and they had a car accident, and kind of similar to Harley Race. Charlie's wife died in the car wreck, and Charlie became an alcoholic rest of his life. This happened to him. He's probably in his early 30s. And during the time frame, all the time frame I knew him, he was subject to drink. When he drank too much. But Charlie was staying in this hotel downtown in Mobile. I wish I could remember the name of the hotel. But anyway, it was a nice hotel. And he would get drunk sometimes. And one day they called my dad up. They said, Mr. Fuller, can you come down here and help us with Charlie? And Dad says, well, what's wrong with him? Is he sick or what? And he goes, no, it's not that, Mr. Fuller. They go, you know, we're just having some problem with him, you know. And Dad says, well, what is it? I mean, you know, what's the problem? And he says, well, he's inebriated. He's really drunk. And he goes, and he's standing where the revolving door is at the entrance to our hotel, and he won't let anybody in or anybody out, and he's naked. I'm sure Dad had a laugh. Oh, boy, this is a good one. So he goes down there, and Charlie didn't, if he didn't respect you, you best stay away from him. You know, he's liable to hurt you. But, you know, he had trained Dad to wrestle, and he actually worked for Dad. So he couldn't do too much to Dad at that point. So, you know, Dad took him and put him upstairs, and got him to his room. And he said, Charlie, you need to stay in your room. So Dad went back. And about an hour later, he got another call, same hotel. They go, hey, Mr. Fuller, we have another little problem with Charlie. Well, what is it? You know, well, you know, we like him. You know, we don't want to kick him out of here. But he's really kind of causing us major problems today. And well, what is it? Dad's like, well, to get to the point, what is it? What's the problem? And he goes, well, he says he's getting on the elevator and he's naked, and he goes to the top floor, and then he pushes all the buttons coming down. And he says, every time, obviously, when the door opens, he's standing there naked. And so Dad says, I'll be there in a minute. So he drives back down to the hotel, and he goes up on the third floor, Dad, to Charlie's floor, and Charlie's not in his room. So he goes to the elevator, and he sees the elevator coming down. So when the door opens up, Charlie's standing there totally nude. And he uses an old term he used to say. As soon as the doors open, he would go, Sabida. And I don't know what that meant. That was his drinking fun. You know, Sabida. So Dad would corral him. He'd get him and take him back. Come on, Charlie. We got to get you back in here in the room, man. You can't be Sabida-ing it up and down the elevator naked all day long, you know. So Charlie lived with me and my brother on a farm just outside of Atlanta. I was a freshman in college at Clemson playing basketball. My brother was a sophomore, junior in high school. And Dad and Mom left, and they put Charlie in charge of us. Charlie was living there. And Charlie had himself a still over in the back of the woods there. He was making his own liquor. And he was drinking quite a bit of it, especially when Dad wasn't around. He knew he couldn't get away with it with Dad being there. but he would go on these binges when Dad left. So Dad and him were going to be gone about 3 days. And the first night, I'm supposed to go back to Clemson. And Rob is scared of Charlie. And Charlie doesn't care as much for Rob. He kind of treated me good. But Rob didn't like to work out too much. And Charlie called him Fat Boy. That was his. He liked to call Rob Fat Boy. So we get up the next morning, and I'm supposed to leave about 4 a.m. and go back to Clemson. And Rob says, no, no, he's begging me. No, no. He goes, Charlie, he's up. Look, he's in the kitchen. We could see through this doorway into the kitchen, and Charlie's in there, and he's staggering. He's drunk. So Rob's like, no, no, you can't leave me here with Charlie by myself. He'll hurt me, you know, all that stuff. So I finally say, okay, all right, we'll see what we can do here. And so Charlie starts trying to make us breakfast, and he opens the refrigerator, and he gets out 2 eggs. And he's 5'8". He's like a fire plug. He's 5'8", probably weighs about 220 pounds, bald-headed, and he's standing in the middle of the floor, and he's staggering, and he's looking at us through that doorway, and he can see us both in there watching him. And he says, I'm going to cook you boys some breakfast. And he's standing in the middle of the floor, and he just fell straight backwards. He never tried to catch himself, just straight back, slammed his back of his head into the refrigerator, and he had 2 eggs in his hand, and he dropped the eggs, and one of them broke over his forehead and ran down his face. He's laying in the floor. He's got nothing on but a pair of underwear. And me and Rob laughed. I mean, you know, it was a funny bump. It's hard to keep from laughing. And so he set up kind of like, you know, when a corpse is laying in a coffin or something, and they sit up real quick. Like, as soon as we started laughing, he sat up on his butt, and he looked through the doorway, and he says to my brother, he didn't pay attention to me, he goes, hey, Fat Boy. I knew he was talking to Rob. And so did Rob. He says, you want to die? I was like, oh, boy, maybe it's a good thing I stayed, Rob. Because I see what was going to happen if I had gone. But Charlie was he was crazy. He was an unreal dude. I mean, Dad said sometimes Mark, back in the day, would show up in towns, and they would come actually into the dressing room, and they would want to challenge wrestlers. And Charlie was the smallest guy of all the wrestlers, basically. He was short, not that big, you know, and didn't look really tough. So Charlie told me a story about one night. He says, yeah, he said, I'm sitting there in the dressing room, and he goes, guy comes in, and he says, he doesn't just open the door, big Mark, he goes, he kicks the door open, and he goes, and he said, he runs through the door where the door was, and he says, there's some metal lockers over there on the far side of the room, and he says, he runs head first into the lockers, bam, and he says, then he turns around, he says, and he looks at everybody in the dressing room, and he says, you know, I'm wondering what's he want? What's this all about? And he says, the guy looks at everybody, and he says, I want to kick the shit out of one of these wrestlers. And so he said, your daddy was there. And he said, your dad said, well, who do you want? And he says, the guy says, he looked at everybody over again, and he says, I'm going to kick the shit out of Charlie Carr. And I started laughing right away because, I mean, the guy had made the wrong choice. He picked the worst one in there to get hold of. And I said, what did you do, Charlie? And he said, what do you think? Like, hot dog, I had myself some fun. It was a different day and time back in those days. Guys were different. Fans were different. Everything was a little bit different, that's for sure. I want to talk a little bit about Killing Town, okay? I have one story maybe I have told before, and I'm not going to tell all of it, but I like to remind people that may have heard it. I think it's one of the great ones. We were going to the Bahamas all the time when I first started wrestling in 1970, 71 in Florida. Everybody hated those trips. We wanted never to go back to the end of the Bahamas again every time we left. And finally, we worked a show. I worked at Partners with Danny Miller. Stu Schwartz was the referee against Dusty Rhodes and Dick Murdoch. And they set up, say, they worked Danny over, got some heat, gave me a hot tag. And I was green as hell. Didn't know. I didn't have any idea what to do when I got in the ring. And when I went in the ring, I was trying to get my hands on somebody. Dusty ran and jumped out on the apron, and Dick started running around in circles. And I was like, well, what do I do here? And Stu Schwartz was the old-time referee, man. He had plenty of experience. And I looked at Stu. I said, what do you do? What do I do? What do I do? And he said, well, I don't know. I don't know. He said, wait a minute. Let's see what's happening here. So Dusty stopped. I mean, Murdoch stopped, and Dusty sat in the corner. And I'm going to head toward Dick, you know, like, well, geez, maybe if he's going to stay there, I can go and at least punch him or do something to him. You know, it's time for a comeback. And Dusty screams at him real loud. The crowd's not doing anything. They don't know what's happening either. So it's dead silence. They can hear everything you're saying in the ring. And Dusty screams real loud at Murdoch. He says, Dickie, get on your bike. And Murdoch throws his leg over an imaginary motorcycle, reaches out and gets the handlebars, starts shaking his body like the bike's running. And he's making noise, and he starts running in circles around me like he's riding a motorcycle. Anyway, you know, we'd been talking about killing the town, but I never expected it to be like this. So I'm looking at Stu, and Stu's looking at me and shaking his head like, I don't know, Ron. I don't know what this one's all about. And finally, Murdoch goes around the ring about three times. I never make a move to go after him. I'd be chasing a guy on a motorcycle. I mean, I'd look like an idiot. So I just stood there. And so Dusty just screams at him, you know, and Dick just, he starts, and then the engine quits, and he takes a bump back on his back in the middle of the ring, and right by my feet, he's laying there now. And I'm like, I look at Stu, you know, like, I don't know what's going on here, man. And Dusty screams real loud at me. He says, he's out of gas, ignorant, cover him. I cover Murdoch, and Stu counts him out. 1, 2, 3. He's run out of gas on his motorcycle. I mean, boy, that was the last show I remember in the Bahamas. And I talked to my brother one time about one. He told me he had gone to Memphis to work for Jarrett. He had been with me in 76, and in 77, they wanted to bring him into Memphis. So they wanted him to bring him in and so as a booker, too, and bring some talent that I had there, too, in 78. So Rob goes to Memphis, and they make a great deal with him. And then they decide, my dad and Jerry, who are partners and own that part of the territory, that they're not going to do the deal that they had originally set up to do before we sent him over there. So, you know, he had the Mongolian Stomper. He had Tony Charles. He had Bob Armstrong. He had Tora Tanaka. He had Mr. Fuji. He had a friggin' phenomenal crew that had gone from Knoxville over there to try to get Memphis off its ass because they were doing bad. So when they changed the deal and they quit paying, he had gotten that territory up. All that group of guys set them on fire over there pretty darn quick. And then they decided they didn't want to pay like they had said they were going to pay. So when that happened, Rob and Fuji, and it's Tanaka and Fuji are tag partners, and Rob, and I think it was Tony Charles this night, are wrestling in Louisville, Kentucky. And, you know, they say, hey, you know, we're leaving. You know, we're leaving because we've gotten screwed here. They promised they were going to pay this type of money. They're not paying the money. The towns are all way up from what they were when they came in. And let's just kill this. They kill this town. So Rob says it. But Fuji says,
I tell you what, Rob, he goes, in the match, somewhere in the match, he goes, I'm going to shoot you in. He said, I'll bend over to backdrop you. And he said, sunset flip me, which is dive over him, basically, and hook his hips when you go over and snatch him backwards. And he lands on his back, and you got your feet over his arms, and you basically got him in pinning position. So Robert says, they work the spot. He calls the spot. Boozy calls spots. Okay, Rob, just going to do that spot. You know, just give me that sunset flip. So they do a little two-stage high spot of some kind. And then Fuji bends over and Rob goes, no, sunset flip him. And instead of catching his hips, he caught his tights, his back of his tights. And when he did, he just pulled his tights totally down off of his ass. And Fuji had gone into the bathroom and stuffed a long roll of toilet paper up his butt. And when Rob went to sunset flipping, the toilet paper fell out onto the floor. But Fuji never went down off the sunset flip. Rob just pulled his pants down. And then Rob rolled out of the way. And Fuji took off running around the ring, dragging that white toilet paper around and around the ring. And Rob told me about it. I was like, oh, my God, man, y'all really did that in Louisville? He goes, that son of a gun, they had screwed us around, you know. We had to do something about it. So, you know, it was crazy what some guys were willing to do back in those days. But you know, the business was great. Amazingly enough, I don't know how the heck that happened. But it certainly did happen. Business just seemed to stay really, really good. I got one last one for you guys. Don Carnoodle. Don Carnoodle, I'm sure if you're familiar with Mid-Atlantic, he worked Mid-Atlantic with Slaughter, with some good guys, tag team champions with several different people. Funny guy, tremendous guy. He worked for me in Southeastern, in Knoxville. In fact, he lived in an apartment with Jimmy Golden. And that was two guys that you just could not, you wouldn't be around them all the time. There was a barrel of monkeys, especially Carnoodle. So Don Carnoodle, he would do a darn near anything. He was just wild. He was crazy. And so I took him to this nightclub out on the edge of Knoxville. They ran every Wednesday night. They have a wet T-shirt contest, and they would have girls come in, and they would wet the T-shirts down. And then, you know, the crowd would judge and then vote on the winner, and they give a prize away. I don't remember what the prizes were. And then the following night, on a Thursday, they would have a wet willy contest. And that was where guys would just go up on stage in their underwear, and they'd wet their underwear, and then the girls would get to pick who was the winner. So Don, one night we're out there and Carnoodle sees the wet willy contest, it's called. And he goes to me and Jimmy, he goes, I got to be in this. I want to be in that contest. Right? So we go, oh, come on, Don. No, you don't need to get in that contest. Oh, yes, I want to be in there. Ron, where are we booked next Thursday? Right. He started checking the book. Right. I said, man, we're in Middlesbrough, Kentucky, you know. I said, we won't get back here in time for you to get in this contest. He said, yeah, we will. We're going to do it, Ron. We just got to do it. He was just dead set on doing it. So here we went to Middlesbrough, Kentucky, me and Jimmy and Carnoodle, so that we could leave early and get back to this nightclub in time for Don Carnoodle to get into the wet willy contest. It was vital for Carnoodle. I mean, it just had to happen. So we drove like crazy from Kentucky back to the west side of Knoxville. And this place was way out kind of in the country, the club was. And it was packed to the walls. And once we went in there, the contest was about to start. In fact, the guys were up on the stage already, and the MC of the contest was introducing them. And we come through the front door of the nightclub. And Carnoodle's like screaming at the top of his lung. And he had this little saying he liked to do. It was his favorite little deal. He would do it 10 times a day. You know, he would get somebody's attention. You know, he would say, Jimmy Golden, sit in my face. And I could never figure out, wait a minute, what? Why would you want somebody to do that? I couldn't figure out why that was his little gimmick. But anyway, it was his gimmick. So anyway, we get to the door of this nightclub, and Carnoodle sees what's going on. It looks like he ain't going to get in the contest. And he just starts snatching off his clothes, going to the stage. And it's so crowded, he can't get there. And he's throwing his shirt in the air. He throws his pants in the air. He throws his shoes off. I mean, he gets to the stage, and he jumps up on the stage. He just takes the microphone away from the MC. There's a guy that's trying to control the deal. You know, there's a pattern to what's supposed to happen. Not with Canoodle, man. He's out of control. And so he gets up there, and he grabs the microphone away from the MC. He looks back there, and Jimmy and I are at this little bar at the front of the place. And as soon as we see him jump up there and turn and get the microphone, we know, oh, man, he is going to let everybody know we're there. We just duck our heads down, try to hide among all the people. And Carnoodle says, Von Fuller and Jimmy Golden, sit in my face. And he screams like that. And then he takes his underwear off. He just snatches them right off, throws them up in the air. It's like pandemonium. I mean, everybody in the place starts laughing, and they just start roaring. Some people are saying, get him out of here, get him off the stage. Other people are going, yeah, look at this, he's great. It was just he had created an unbelievable scene. In just a few minutes, he had taken over the entire program. It took him about 10 minutes, and before they threw us all three out of the place. I mean, they couldn't get him off the stage, and the cops came up to get him, and they knew who he was, and they were like, oh, Don, we don't want to mess with you, man. Come on, can you please just go ahead and leave? Don, you've had a good time. Haven't you had a good time? Let's just go ahead and see if we can get you out of here, Don. I'm sure you'll be all right. We can just get your clothes, find your clothes. I mean, it was just one thing after another with Don Carnoodle. Him and Jimmy Golden living together was a phenomenal pair of guys, and did they have some fun? I have one more
thing. The important thing, Ron, in a story like that is, were they laughing at him or were they laughing with him?
I think there was some laughing at him and some laughing with him.
Okay.
I think probably more was laughing at him, to be honest with you, than laughing with him. I'm going to tell you one more quick one. This is about Jack Briscoe. And this is an odd one because, you know, Jack Briscoe, not only was he one of the greatest wrestlers of all time, he comported himself very well. He was pretty much always in control. And every once in a while, Jack liked to drink, but he was pretty good at handling it most of the time. But we're wrestling in San Juan, Puerto Rico. We're going to fly out of San Juan's commercial airport that night after the matches. And we're flying back into Miami. And but we got to wait probably 45 minutes to get on the plane. The airport is two levels. Where you buy your tickets and get your ticket arrangements, they had these big, long fountains. The fountains were 30 feet long and 10, 15 feet wide. They went the entire length of the front of the airport. It was a pretty nice airport for back in, this is 1973, I'm going to think, 72, 73, way back. And so Jack Briscoe, me, Bob Roop, Joe Flaherty, several other guys. We're all in a little group. We've worked our way upstairs. We've already got our tickets and everything, and we're upstairs. Joe Flaherty is a young kid. He's green. He's not been in the business very long. He's the opposite of Jack. He has no control of himself. He doesn't have any idea of what to do and what not to do. And he's just a wild kid. And so Jack's a little upset. Jack's like tired of it. You know, and he's like, get away, Joe. You know, get out of the way. You know, and Joe wasn't smart enough to realize, Joe, you're messing with the wrong dude. You know, you need to back off. And so this went on for a while. And you know, in San Juan, not everybody spoke English. In fact, a lot of people didn't speak English at all. So we're upstairs. There's this big railing by where we are, and we're kind of sitting in these chairs waiting to get on the plane. And Flaherty starts doing something with Jack. I can't remember what it was, but for some reason, he pushes Jack backwards to where there's a railing, and down below the railing, and that with a good 15-20 foot drop, is these big water fountains all along there, maybe 3 feet deep. So he pushes Jack back toward the railing, and Jack just kind of hits up with his butt right by the railing, and then Flaherty charges him. I don't know what he's thinking, you know, like, you know, he's going to hit him with a tackle and try to knock him over the railing. He's going to do something crazy, right? Now, Jack just bent over and backdropped him from that upper level off of that second level and down into that fountain below. I mean, Flaherty weighed about 260 pounds. Water went everywhere over the downtown floor, over that floor, the downstairs floor of the airport. And we weren't, 20 seconds later, I mean, there's three policemen right in Jack's face. And they don't speak English. So, God, man, now we're trying to explain to them that, I mean, this is just a rib. It's just a joke, right? Thank God Flaherty didn't hit his head on the pool down there. He happened to hit right in the center of the water and saved his life, actually. So Flaherty, you know, takes this big bump, by God, and the cops are right there, and they're wanting to take Jack to jail. And we finally find somebody there that can talk for us to get Jack out of trouble. And we end up catching the flight back we fly out of there. But Flaherty's all wet. He can't, they won't let him on the plane. So he ends up on Lester's private plane, Lester Welch, which is, that's my dad's uncle, Roy's, my grandfather's youngest brother. And Lester flew planes. And he flew planes, and he would take half the crew on Lester's plane, and the other half would fly commercial. Well, this night, we're flying commercial. But Joe's got to get on the plane with Lester. Well, Lester's pissed off at him because he's wet, and he's sitting in Lester's airplane seat. Lester didn't like it much. He's drunk to begin with. So they fly. When they get off at the airport in Miami, at the private airport in Miami, they're going to get Flaherty off the plane. He's the last one to come off the plane. And Lester's pissed at him. And the guys tell us about this the next day. They say Flaherty's at the top of the little stairs. It was two steps down to the runway off the back of the plane. It's a private plane, only held about 10 passengers. And Flaherty gets to that top level, and Lester reaches up there and arm dragged him off onto the tarmac, onto the concrete. They said, what a bump. You missed the best bump. So Flaherty had been backdropped into a pool in the Puerto Rican airport and arm dragged off the airplane in Miami. So it was a great night for Flaherty, but, you know, it was a wonderful time back in those days, being a wrestler. It was just a tremendous time to be alive.
Well, I know that Flaherty's career didn't last really long. I wonder if that's part of the reason.
Yeah, he never had any brains. I mean, you know, he didn't have brains enough to be a wrestler. And that's saying a lot, you know, because there's a lot of wrestlers.
Maybe the bar wasn't very high. Is that what you're saying, Ron?
Yeah, I'm saying, you know, the standard's not real high sometimes when it comes to wrestlers. But Joe was even low on that standard. By that standard, he was an accident looking for some place to happen, and he got two accidents that night. It was a good night for Joe.
He suffered enough having to fly back with your dad's uncle.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Lester was a trip. Flying with Lester was absolutely crazy. I remember flying one trip from San Juan to Freeport in the Bahamas. You leave San Juan about midnight. You get into Freeport about 4 in the morning. And we flew out of there. And Lester would fill his plane. He would go to sleep. And, you know, when and he was the only pilot on the plane. So you got eight guys in there and Lester, and he's flying the plane. Somebody's sitting in the co-pilot seat. Sometimes nobody's sitting in the co-pilot seat. This night, nobody's sitting in the co-pilot seat. So when he would go to sleep, everybody else would wake up. We'd all say, hell, man, if we're all asleep and something happens, he won't know and we'll all crash. But if we're awake, maybe we'll know. So it was one of those nights when we're all awake and Lester's asleep. And all of a sudden, the plane starts to go, and starts missing like something's wrong. And then it goes, and then it just dies. And then it noses over, and boy, here we go. Right? And Lester's still asleep. He's up there. He never hears anything. He never even knows what's going on, has no idea. And he's up there by himself. And everybody in the plane goes, Lester, 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 hey, the plane, the plane. And so by this point, the plane's nosed over. It's going down. We're headed down. We're probably up maybe though 12,000 feet or so. And so he looks back at everybody with his disgusted look like, what is wrong with you guys? And he reaches down there and he flips on the auxiliary tank. Which is the second tank, and he just drops his head back and goes to sleep immediately. It's like, and the plane has not even got its altitude back yet. And then it starts going, and then finally it gets it's getting all its gas, and it slowly gets its altitude. I mean, riding with him was a nightmare. It was like you never knew what the heck was going to happen. And we had a lot of other bad incidents in that same plane, too.
Ron, great fun on the Super Stud Cast, as always. Plenty of stories. Naked wrestlers, you know. You just can't get enough of naked wrestlers.
So. No, we don't do very much of this.
We didn't even get to Ric Flair, for God's sakes. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, we'd have had to give a whole episode to that.
I think so. We'll listen on it.
It'd take a whole episode to take care of Rick's naked escapades. But it was real fun. I really enjoyed it today, Jeff. And for the patrons out there, I always want to thank everybody out there who is a patron and appreciate your support very much. Hope you've enjoyed this one. This one is a little bit different. I apologize for not being able to have Sid on as I'd wanted to, but I hope that in his absence, I've given you a laugh or two, and it's just a real honor to be able to have the opportunity to be able to do these Super Stud Cast, and thank you very much, Jeff, and you also, Lou, for your production skills here and getting this done. And we look forward to doing the next one, which I think Jeff is going to be on Tuesday, March the 17th, if I'm not incorrect.
That is correct, sir. So on behalf of our host, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I am Jeff Baldron. And for our producer, Sweet Lou Kippelman, the Super Stud Cast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And until next time, when the ride continues.
Thank you for being a patron and supporting all Studcast with your donation for this month's Super Studcast and the rest of the story. We're honored to bring these super events to our growing list of donors and appreciate your comments and feedback so we can continue to improve upon the 3 hours of unique and focused content we hope you've enjoyed. We encourage you to tell your friends about the Super Studcast and the rest of the story so the stud can continue to highlight the awesome history of his family and the sport we all love. So saddle up and ride the second and fourth Sunday of each month as we open the vault and spotlight wrestling history. This is David Summers thanking you on behalf of all the staff, including the great Brian Last and Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud, saying so long from the great Smoky Mountains. Another Super Studcast is done.